Welcome to Claret in Conversation, a podcast of voices from the creative industry. Here, we explain voices about how we ended up where we ended up, and we share great works of art that inspired us and that we, in turn, create. These are our first few episodes, and we're really pleased that we've had the opportunity to come together. My name is Katie Espester, and I'm the editor and publisher behind Claret Press and Clapham Publishing Services. Our guest today is Kees Het Hooft. Kees Het Hooft is a Dutchman who came to London in 1979 to study film at the International Film School, which in those days was based in Covent Garden. And I bet you've got some great stories about playing around Covent Garden in those in the 1970s and 80s. He went from film school to work as an editor, notably for David Lean on Passage to India. He then made the sideways transfer to being a cameraman director on outdoor documentaries, climbing Mount Everest with actor Brian Blessed, walking across the Canadian Arctic in an effort to retrace the final footprints of the doomed Franklin expedition, and getting stuck in a snow cave in South Georgia in the Antarctic with famed British mountaineer Stephen Venables, the first Briton to climb Mount Everest without additional oxygen. Now he works as an engineer at a sustainable energy startup. What a life, Kees. What a transition from film to engineering. How did that all happen?
Basically, very indulging liberal parents who are very liberal in the direction I was going in and didn't mind as long as I stayed out of prison. So
the bar was low, is that what you're saying?
Very modest.
Bless their hearts.
And I make sure it was that from a very young age. Now, I grew up in a small town, in a small old town, very middle class, sort of petty bourgeois kind of way. Very loving, caring, accustomed environment. And of course, in those days, everybody who was young was dreaming of going to places far, far away and exploring places. And that's something which stayed with me. And therefore, the step ultimately to go to London to do a course in filmmaking was actually quite logical. And I'm not the only one who did that from that background. And I had the most amazing time here, meeting people I would not have dreamt to have met in any other circumstance.
Not even kind of crazy Amsterdam and the there's always this impression somehow that Amsterdam is this decadence and self-indulgence.
But it didn't happen to me. Happen
How did you miss it?
Nobody
else did. Everybody else in the 80s in Amsterdam in the film industry, my gosh, it must have been one hedonistic experience to the next.
No, actually, Amsterdam was full. People, when people became successful, the first thing they did was leave Holland to Paris.
Why?
Because life was more exciting there. And certainly amongst people who were serious filmmakers, the first opportunity they had was to go to Hollywood as Paul Verhoeven and Jan de Bont are testament to.
What did they do?
Well, they became Hollywood directors.
I see.
One was responsible for Speed.
Oh, yeah, I remember Speed.
Speed. The other one, RoboCop.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That was
Everybody's
Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing at school sort of a black and white movie Paul Verhoeven made at school. So you always dreamt of meeting people and going to places which were far away.
So, okay, so here you were working in the film industry in London. Did you always know you wanted to go into film? Was this something that hit you from a young age?
Not really. Things like that happen.
You fell into making films?
No, at first it seemed that photography was... that's something which just fascinated me. And I was fascinated by the process, by also how a photograph came about. With hindsight, I wasn't particularly good at it, but it did fascinate me, and it still does.
So this engagement with photography and cameras is what spurred you into going into film work. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. I like when you come as a young person in contact with films. In those days, a lot was happening in film. Every year, something happened that made new films, a new approach to filming possible. When I was little, it was impossible to record sound and film at the same time. It was always done separately, or it had to be done in a studio specially equipped for recording sound. And when I was little, the people invented cameras which ran so silently that you could had an idea of a fly on the wall documentary that was born in those days, that you could just quietly move about. The equipment was so small that you could carry it all by hand and could make films which just really reflected real life.
So it's funny because we always have this impression that somehow technology is something that has, you know, the digital age has catapulted us into a different reality. And this is a completely, it's not just a modern phenomenon, it's a phenomenon of the last 15 years. And what you're saying is actually in the film industry, it's almost part and parcel of the film industry is this, you know, this transformative technology once every few years that completely reworks the,
oh yeah,
the kit, if you wish, which then changes the nature of
what you can do. In those days, the filmmakers based in France were very much at the forefront of what could be done with new equipment and new approaches to filmmaking, like Jean-Luc Godard and Jean Rouch, who did groundbreaking work, and then sort of followed by filmmakers in the States and other countries.
Mm. Can you give us an example of a great work of art, though, that really inspired you to go enter the creative industry and become kind of a freelance cameraman director?
Not one thing. Like, well, when you say a work of art, think of a piece of machinery, which is almost like a work of art. That's the Aaton film camera, which was designed by a Frenchman.
I'm sorry, did you say Aaton?
Aaton, yeah.
A-T-O-N?
Double A-T-O-N.
That's not a French name, double A-T.
Yeah, but it is a thought-up name, made-up name, because with two A's, he reckoned he would be at the top of every list.
Now, that's a good strategic thinking that you need to have if you want to thrive in the creative industry. You just can't be lost in the clouds. You've got to have a strategic muscle that you exercise regularly. Okay, so the Aaton camera is what...
Which was just very, very French in its approach. Everything done with a minimum of complexity, but very efficient. I mean, in those days, what was a mark of what a good film camera was whether the picture was stable, because the whole process of pulling a bit of film together down and then exposing it and pull the next bit of film together, you have to make sure that the picture is always in exactly the same place, and that's called, well, the steadiness of the picture. And there were, in those days, a German camera manufacturer, Arri Flex, and they made a camera which had a special mechanism which was very complicated to keep that picture very steady. And it was good. But the Aaton camera did away with that complex mechanism and made something far simpler. And the picture was as stable, if not more stable than the Arri picture. So it was a true work of art, that camera. And the beauty of that camera was it designed by a lone inventor, and he just fabricated the camera by ordering all the elements in and just assemble it at his flat in Grenoble. That was his operation, and it became a world famous camera.
Oh, and did he live long enough to see that happen and benefit from it?
He did, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I love these happy endings. How fantastic.
But that camera made sort of a way of filmmaking possible, which was just massive. It opened new worlds, literally.
So, Case, it sounds to me, when you're talking about great works of art and you're including the invention of the Acton camera, is that what it's called?
Acton camera,
the
yeah.
Acton camera. It seems to me you're very inspired by two things that most people define contradictory. One is an engineering, and one is the visual arts. And most people wouldn't put those in the same box.
I think that is just a result of my schooling. I should have been an engineer, but I wasn't very good at school. So having nice liberal parents said, well, you're not very good at school, so you must be artistic. So do that.
But besides your schooling, it seems to me that you have not accepted the normal parameters of what is a work of art. I'm not sure most people would choose a camera as a work of art. It's just a little unusual. I think it's fantastic. It's not a criticism.
No.
I find it slightly, it breaks apart my understanding of what constitutes a work of art, that you've put the two together into one.
Well, I would say works of art are any expressions of, strictly speaking, a piece of machinery. It is there to fulfill a function, but it can be done in different ways, which turns it into almost a piece of art. But I would say works of art are sort of expressions of a higher being on earth, be it is it a beautiful garden, a beautiful piece of sculpture, a painting, anything, which materializes something which is very much part of the human condition.
So you mean almost the expression of the divine?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. So, well, this has turned into a bit of a philosophical discussion. How does this person who is very philosophically oriented end up living the life of an adventurer? You've gone all over the world filming people doing things that are frequently quite dangerous.
Yeah, but it's
which
not,
has also put you in danger, too.
Yeah, but it's not exclusive.
True, you can do. So you're saying you can do both. Does the divine show up in danger too?
Well, it makes you feel alive if you survive.
I suppose. Thank
anyway,
God.
Anyway, danger in my case, it was all of fairly modest, I must say.
Well, you were in Mount Everest. The year was that 1996. 1996,
yeah.
The year of the killer storm they turned into movies and provoked a controversy about tourists going up Mount Everest. At that point, you were a well-established freelance cameraman director working for different agencies and So why am I telling you your story? Please tell me.
Well, and the thing is that I was there doing a job. I was there filming, but it was also, it turned out to be a thoroughly pleasant experience with wonderful people. But I was not in any sense going to risk my life.
What was it like working with Brian Blessed?
Well, he was the subject of the film, because we were meant to film his sort of final attempt to get to the summit, which there was a possibility that he would make it in the event he didn't. But I was reasonably familiar with his public image when we started this project. So I wasn't quite looking forward to spending sort of 6 weeks with that kind of a person.
Well, he's larger than life, isn't he?
Yeah. But once we started traveling together, he turned out to be the most wonderful travel companion you can imagine. Very self-effacing, very modest, very considerate of other people. And so we had a lovely time, actually.
Wonderful. So how is it that you ended up being in this enviable position of being paid to go on adventures with people like Brian Blessed.
You just meet people, and those, hey, if you're lucky, the people you meet, they see something what you're doing, and when there is an opportunity to do some work with those people, they do it. And that's the wonderful. That's the actually only thing I miss of not working as a cameraman any longer or editor was that, especially in the film and television industry, you keep meeting people, and that is more wonderful than anything. When you're in a studio and you work with people, well, people, when the work is done, everybody packs up and goes home. But when you find yourself with somebody on Everest or some expedition, then you live on top of one another for 6, 8 weeks, maybe longer. So then you get to know each other very well, and things happen along the way.
And adventures.
Adventures, but also really that you find out what makes other people tick. And that is a wonderful thing. So, yeah, life is really meeting people. And doing this kind of more adventurous work is more wonderful than anything. When you do start on a first speculative project and you travel to faraway countries basically out of your own pocket and then manage to sell the film, well, that's a great thing, but you go somewhere for the very first time and it's all very exciting. And then you become professional and you do that for a living and you go to faraway, very beautiful places but for the umpteenth time. So it's not excited them anymore. You've seen it before and you know exactly how to get beautiful pictures. But in the evening, most people just go to the hotel room and take it easy. At that moment, I thought, well, the fun is gone.
So tell us about the transition that you made then. So here you are. I'm just trying to do a kind of a understand how you went from A to B to C to D. You start off small, you work your way up the ladder, you become so successful that ultimately, ironically, unpredictably, bizarrely, it becomes a bit humdrum and the fun goes out of it.
Well, that's also the
point. And so you change your life.
Yeah, well, it also happened that I got married and got little children. And when you have babies, you don't want to be too far away from them. And that was the big difference. And now there was a friend who I also met during a filming project, and he was in a similar position. And he said, well, why don't we set up a company to turn waste cooking oil into biodiesel? And he said, well, okay, well, I'll help you with that. And then it turned out that my involvement was a bit more involved than I initially had envisaged. And that became a full-time job, and it still is. And it is something which I could not have imagined in my worst nightmares to have done. But now I'm doing it. It is... I wish I've done something like that 30 years earlier.
In other words, what you're saying is that your life changed. And because life changed, your priorities changed. And because your priorities changed, you sought out other ways of living, living a life that was meaningful for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we undervalue in the creative industry is how flexible we are. That we think, okay, what works, what doesn't? Does this work? It doesn't work. Okay, we're going to change it. We're going to do something else. Like I think relative to other industries, we're not stuck in a rut, which I think you're a beautiful example of. Mm-hmm. So now here you are. You've started. You're in a startup. You're in a little tiny chemical processing plant, creating machinery. You're building machinery now.
That's what turned out. Yeah.
You're more or less inventing machines to do this more efficiently, more effectively.
But without the benefit of any education in engineering.
Is that a benefit though? Like, it doesn't seem to have hampered you. I have to tell you that. You know, it doesn't seem to have slowed you down.
You figure things out. So it takes you, say, several days, which somebody who has a bit of training takes 5 minutes. And then you have those suppliers who have a technical support department and you ask them questions. And of course, in my case, often the questions I asked were so stupid that they didn't bother answering them. But then it became quite obvious what the answer was, so I figured it out. But it's amazing what you can find out, especially with the internet.
You can teach yourself.
Yeah, you can find people who know.
But, you know, I think that when you're in the creative industry, and I would say that inventing machines is part of the creative industry, what we have to teach ourselves is substantial. Like, I've had to teach myself bookkeeping and accounting. And I've absolutely no doubt that if I was an accountant, this would be much easier. Mm. But it's just one of the many, many things that you have to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
So here you are with your business partner,
mm-hmm.
and you're creating a green fuel. Now, these kinds of companies have a very high infant mortality. How long have you been in production for?
12 years.
Oh, well, I'd say we're pushing into teenage years. Mm-hmm. We've gone from infant through childhood and pushing in on puberty. Well, and that's tell us more about this company.
Well, it's a company we founded, well, I think it's close to 13 years ago. And in those days, one of those things which were encouraged by the government, they set in motion a system by which small companies could establish themselves as collectors and processors of waste cooking or processors of biodiesel. So it was very easy to start up, and a lot of people sunk their life savings into companies like that, and an awful lot went bust.
And why didn't yours?
Because we could not afford to go bust.
Okay, I'm not sure that I don't want to. This is not a. I don't want to disagree with you. It's just that the ability or the inability to go bankrupt tends not to be a factor in going bankrupt. It tends to happen whether you want it to or not.
Yeah, well, in our case, we had nowhere else to go. So you just make sure that if there's a problem, you solve it. And if there's another problem, you solve that. And we managed to do it. Because
what kind of problems?
Anything to do with the commercial aspects of getting hold of enough waste oil at the right price, because it turned out you had to pay for it.
Yes, of course.
To selling it to people who then find that it wrecks their car.
Uh-oh.
So you have to come to some kind of settlement of, to make sure that the car is fixed and they don't sue you.
But you know, this whole thing with diesel reminds me of the kerfuffle over Volkswagen, which, you know, we're now trying to get rid of diesel cars.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
I would think that would be a huge problem with creating biodiesel.
At the time, it seemed to be a good idea. That years later, it's less of a good idea. That's only natural. Things keep changing. So now our business is moving on to make a purer biodiesel. And that can be used by heavy haulage lorries. And for the time being, they will be running on diesel. Maybe not in cities, but certainly on the motorways.
What do you mean by purer? Biodiesel.
Well,
surely biodiesel is biodiesel. I mean, diesel's diesel, petrol's petrol.
Well, as it turns out, not quite. In the last 10 years, last many years, the engines have been refined to run more cleaner, more efficient. But it also means that they have become very, they need fuel of ever narrower specifications. In the old days, a diesel engine could run on salad oil, on olive oil, anything you put in it. It ran on it, didn't matter. And nowadays, that cannot happen any longer.
I'm not an engineer, so I'm just going to have to ask you some questions that are probably going to sound just moronic. Doesn't that make the world a worse place if your engines now are so finickety that you can't put salad oil in it and make it work? Like, surely it would have been better to have an engine that could run on anything.
Well, the engine that can run on everything is also very dirty.
Ah, so you're saying that the gunk that it puts into our air that produces smog that we all breathe is killing Londoners.
Anything else? What if it's not fine particles? It is something else.
So you're saying that you're inventing machines which produce a purer form of fuel that pollutes our air less and less.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much, by the way. On behalf of those of us who enjoy inhaling and exhaling, can I just say thank you for your contribution to making my air cleaner?
Well,
can we make sure that VW, Volkswagen, gets your kinds of machines? Because Volkswagen needs it, because they're the ones who screwed it all up in the first place.
Yeah, well, we make it. In the greater scheme of things, we make a tiny amount of fuel.
How much is tiny?
It's about 30,000 liters a week.
So how much waste oil is produced in London?
We think about 30 million liters a year.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot. 30 million is a lot. And you're producing 30,000 liters a week of biodiesel.
Yeah, so a tiny amount compared of what's possible. But a lot of the vegetable oil is bought by companies who process it in places like Liverpool or even Glasgow.
Why don't they produce their own waste vegetable oil?
Yeah, but they need so much. And I think that if you compare the amount of waste vegetable oil available compared to the need of diesel, that is a small percentage. And you have to take into account had a production cost, a transportation cost.
Yes.
But now, as it turns out, there are other waste streams from industry which are suitable for alternative fuels, which turn out, in some instances, are very, very clean fuels. So there's always new things to explore and to develop.
So, Case, it strikes me that as someone who has moved from the film industry into the green industry, you have created a wide range of artifacts, if you wish, from editing Passage to India to fly-on-the-wall documentaries to now innovative pieces of machinery that improve our air quality. Of all of these, which are you most proud of?
Actually, none of the above. we did an interview with the curator of a Vermeer exhibition, and he was asked, what is your favorite Vermeer? And he said, well, every day it's a different one. And I think that in my case, that's also true. It's a different one. And I think if you ask that question for anybody who is a parent, of course, then the children are the most precious, the most wonderful thing. Have far outshining anything you produced otherwise. So that's...
Well, that's, in an odd way, an unsurprising answer, that you have chosen everything and and again, and it put it into a philosophical framework that, depending on how you understand what your day is, depends on what you choose as your favorite. That's unsurprising. So what's next for you, Case? What's next for your company, Pure Fuels? What do you see as coming down the line? Are you going to now change fields again? Or are you going to move from being an engineer to doing something else creative? I don't know, maybe cooking or fashion?
No, I think there's still a lot more to do with the company and develop
new machines you need to make.
New machines and new projects, new, because we're now producing different kinds of fuels, which probably have a very, very good future, we hope.
Oh, God, I hope so. As somebody who likes to breathe, I really hope so.
And also when it comes to automating machinery, what fascinates me, how that you automate it in a way that people actually like working with the machinery. So that you, when something goes wrong, that the person operating the machine knows exactly what's happening and how to put it right.
We've gone full circle back to the acting camera, haven't we?
Well, almost, yeah.
So this is kind of gone full circle. So it's not just that it's a beautiful piece of machinery that you've built. You want the person who is using your machinery to enjoy the experience of it.
Yeah. And not only, but that you feel in control and that you have a part to play. Because if your only function is to press a button at a certain certain point, well, where is the honor in that? Then somebody comes up away with a way to press that button automatically at a given time, and you see that now with the two air crashes which happened recently, that the aircraft was designed to fly in such a way that it was sort of taken away from the pilots, the control.
It strikes me that in the way you're discussing machines is the way people discuss art. So you have to interact with art, and you have to interact with the way it seems and what it means to the person viewing it. You're discussing machinery in the same way as if it's a work of art. It has to, people have to interact with your pieces of machinery that you create in a way that engages the human. It engages human beings. Can we go back to something? So you have said that you had a very gentle education, of which very little was asked out of you, and you made sure you did not exceed expectations, shall we say. Do you think that very open, fluid education you had with very few barriers assisted you in being the kind of creator that you are?
More by accident than design, I would say.
I just can't help but compare it to the standardized exams, the GCSE, the A levels. They're so rigid. They're so narrow, the education system is here. You know, it's a Tuesday in March, and therefore you're going to be on page 46 of a math book. Everybody in the whole country is. You know, and it's so regimented now. And there have been criticisms of our education system that it is it's not actually benefiting us in the long run because it stifles creativity. Would you agree with that, given your own, shall we say, more liberal educational background?
Well, I really don't know. I just look at my own children, and they seem to be thriving in that environment. And it hasn't stopped them to be showing plenty of initiative and a sense of adventure when given the opportunity.
So you're suggesting then that your creativity, your ability to walk between fields of art, editing, photography, camera, engineering, is not thanks to your education, but it's down to more just case at home having.
The family, friends, the much greater community I grew up in.
I see.
Because where the schooling I had was a Montessori school, and Montessori was always. It was a very liberal interpretation of the Montessori method, which didn't do me much good. Because if you hadn't done your tasks you were expected to do at school, you did them next week. And of course, before I knew it, I had sort of 3 weeks to catch up with because I wasn't producing anything at school. Well, in a more disciplined environment, it would have been brought to a conclusion sooner or later. And so procrastination had been part of my being for a long time.
Okay, so if I could just interpret this, what you're actually saying is necessity is the mother of invention. It's not the education system. Things changed. You needed a change.
Yeah.
And you drew on this creative wellspring that you've got to change yourself and your job and move in dramatically different directions.
Yeah. Sort of tough love.
Okay. Was it a hard transition?
At the time, yes.
Any words of advice you can give anybody else?
Well, don't try to avoid dread.
Don't avoid dread.
Because you have this feeling of dread, which I've been trying to avoid. Whenever I was put in a situation which filled me with dread, I try to avoid it.
Well, don't we all? Isn't that human nature?
Well, sometimes you have to get through it.
I see. So you make these big transitions from doing big films like Passage to India to little kind of small contracts going with endless little documentaries to moving into engineering. These are just, you embrace the fear.
I had to.
You had to.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm. Well, this has been a very thought-provoking discussion. Thank you very much for participating in it. And please just keep inventing machines that help us breathe. If I have a vote about what you do next in your future, I'm voting for you continuing to make machines that clean our air, that are as beautiful as the Acton camera. Thank you very much to Case at Hope of Pure Fuels. Make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast, and follow us on Facebook or subscribe to our newsletter to keep up with the latest news, events, and podcast updates. The newsletter is available through our Claret Press website or our Clapham Publishing Services website. Claret in Conversation is hosted by myself, Katie. It's produced by Alex Holmes and edited and engineered by Chelsea Moore. We've had additional assistance from Hugo Zhang.